Elizabeth Cecilia Clephane lived from 1830, a very short period of time, only 39 years, born in 1830. She was responsible for two songs that we sing not very often. One, not very often, the 90 and 9, which is a great song. It's a wonderful narrative song. The words aren't always easily matched with the tune, so we kind of struggle through it on that account, but that song is known by some of us and sung sometimes. But the other song is better known. In fact, it's one of my favorite of the songs to be used in the eulogy or any other time. It's the song Beneath the Cross of Jesus. I fain would take my stand. The shadow of a mighty rock within a weary land. But the second verse has the phrase that has always intrigued me, because it uses a word that we don't use very often at all. And then it brings this concept that I want to go into detail with you today that is just fascinating to me. The phrase is this: oh, trysting place, where heaven's love and heaven's justice meet. Trysting place. When I was a boy, the very first time I led that song, I said trysting place. It just looked like T-R-Y, try, sting, but it's trysting. It comes from the same root word as the word trust. A trusting place. But it has a different meaning. It's clearly more than that. Trysting and trusting are similar, but not the same. A trysting place is a place where lovers meet. So if Paula and I, when we were here on campus as students, I would say, I'll meet you on the steps of the Aiken Building after we finish class today. And we would sit on the steps of the Aiken Building and talk. A trysting place. A place where lovers meet. Now take that thought. Take that thought. A trysting place where love and heaven's justice meet. I'm in Genesis 18. I'm not sure there's a better place for me to show you what I think Elizabeth Clephane was referring to. By the way, that song Beneath the Cross of Jesus is just filled with pictures and symbols and connections of the Old Testament. So many of them. Beautifully written song. But I can't think of a better place to talk about the trysting place where love and justice meet than Genesis chapter 18. So we're going to be here for a few minutes, and then I'm hoping everything we're talking about is pushing you in a narrower and narrower way to come to the supper today and to do what my brother Rike said in his opening remarks, which were just beautifully offered to us today. I want you to have a deeper appreciation for what Jesus did for us than you've had before you came here. And it's not just about information. It isn't just about, wow, I never saw that. That's interesting. I know that. But, wow, I never saw that, or I haven't thought about that. But my goodness, my good God, what you have done for me. I can only celebrate with greater thankfulness in my heart. That's where I want to take you today. You ready? Genesis chapter 18 shows us two faces of God. And the first of them is shown in the beginning of the chapter, the God of love. I want you to picture this scene. It says, verse 1, "Now the Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre." while he was sitting at the tent door in the heat of the day. The Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre. And I want to suggest to you, Abraham never forgot the oaks of Mamre. Not because those oaks were incredible or beautiful or they were wonderful, but that God appeared to him there at the oaks of Mamre. God appeared to him. There are only three cases. This is the third. There are only three cases at this point of God having appeared to Abraham. He appeared to him in chapter 12 when he made the promise to him, get out of this country and go to a place I'm going to show you. He appeared to him in chapter 17 when God said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to make a great nation out of you, and your descendants are going to bless the world. And then here, and then here. So it's not like Abraham says, oh, God, it's you again. Nice to see you. I guess it's been a couple of days since we've seen each other. That the God of heaven would appear to Abraham. I mean, I don't know what that would be in any way a parallel for you, but it might be this. I go to the door because the doorbell rings, and I go to the door and open it up, and when I open up the door, Paul McCartney's there. He doesn't just say, I'm looking for something, or I'm working for Amazon now, or anything like that. He says, Ralph, I came to see you. That would just bowl me over. And you may have a person like that. Might be a political figure, might be an author, might be an actor, might be a great athlete, knocked on your door. I'm here. God appears to Abraham, which in and of itself says how relationally oriented God is. He's not just giving information to Abraham. He wants to give it to him in person. And so then it says, he lifted up his eyes. There were three men, and he saw him. He ran, and he bowed himself to the earth. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about this, but I think one of them is the representation of God. I think it's probably a Christophany. It's probably the Son who is appearing here, not the Father who said to Moses, you can't see me and live. This is probably the Christophany, Jesus representing the Father as the God figure here, and two with him. That doesn't mean that Abraham would have recognized him as that. He would have only recognized him as ultimate deity. There are three of them there. Two angelic beings who have a second mission that they're going on to perform in a few minutes we'll talk about. And Abraham says, My Lord, if I found favor in your sight, don't pass me by. Please, let a little water be brought. Wash your feet. Rest yourselves under the tree. I'll bring a piece of bread that you may refresh yourselves. And after that, you may go on since you visited your servant. In other words, I can't believe you're here. I don't want to be in the way, but I would love to offer you whatever you need. I know you probably have a lot to do. But if you could just sit for a few minutes, that's all I'm asking. That's all I would want. And so he hurried into the tent, verse 6 says. He says to Sarah, quickly prepare three measures of fine flour, knead it, make bread cakes. He ran to the herd, took a tender and choice calf, gave it to the servant. And he hurried to prepare it. Look at how Abraham is frenetic about this. He runs inside, make some bread. And boy, Sarah's going at it. That's not an easy task to make bread quickly. And certainly not easy to go grab a calf, kill it, and dress it, and prepare it quickly. But all of this is being done to accommodate this relationship with God, who graciously participates in his hospitality. again, if I may go back to the parallel, and I'm not in any way, shape, or form saying anybody I would think of in this earth would in any way compare to God, but it would probably be a little presumptuous of me to say to Paul McCartney, hey, by the way, come on in. I've got some songs I've written I'd like you to listen to. Could I entertain you for a while? I wouldn't do that. Here's a God of all the universe, and he's coming to the tent of Abraham. And Abraham prepares food for the God who owns the cattle of 1,000 hills. And what does God do? This is nice. I'll eat that. That's really, I'll have another piece of bread. This is very good. How gracious. How kind, how thoughtful God is with Abraham. And so they eat. He took curds and milk and the calf, placed it before him, and he was standing by them under the tree as they ate. Abraham doesn't even presume to sit down with them. He's just going to stand there and see if there's anything they need. You need anything else? I'll go get it. And then God speaks. Where is Sarah, your wife? Verse 9. And he said, well, she's there in the tent. And he said, I'm going to return to you at this time next year. And behold, Sarah, your wife, will have a son. Sarah was listening at the tent door, which was behind him. And Abraham and Sarah were old. They were advanced in age. Sarah was, look, I'm going to insert something here. Sarah was way past childbearing. She's in her 90s. Way past childbearing. So Sarah laughed to herself. Said, after I become so old, shall I have pleasure? My Lord, being old also, will I have the pleasure of a child after all this time? Could that possibly happen? See, I'm not even speaking it to you as the person, and I'm chuckling about it. It's ridiculous to think she will have a child. And the Lord said, why'd Sarah laugh? Is anything too difficult for the Lord? At the appointed time, I'll return to you at this time next year, and Sarah will have a son. They've been worried about that since chapter 12. When God said to them, I'll make of you a great nation, Abraham looked and it was him and his wife and there's nobody else. And then when God spoke again in chapter 17 and won't accept Ishmael in place of a natural born child, well, how is this going to happen? He's been worried about that, and here God comforts him with it. God gives him the answer. No, don't worry. It's going to happen. It's going to happen for you. And then I love this. One more thought before we move to the second half. He treated Abraham as a friend. Look at verse 16. The men rose up and they looked down towards Sodom. Abraham was with them to send them off. And the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Since Abraham will surely become a great and mighty nation, and in him all the nations of the earth will be blessed, I've chosen him so that he may command his children, his household after him, to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring upon Abraham what he's spoken about him. Tangential point, I'll run past it. Men who have children in this audience, there is not a better worded mission for you than what is stated right here. It's what fathers are supposed to do. Command their children. Do you notice that? Command their children and the household to keep the way of the Lord. Nothing more important than that. Nothing more important than commanding your family both by example and word. This is the most important thing that will ever occur in your life. Keep the way of the Lord. And how do we do that? By doing righteousness and justice. Oh, teach your children what righteousness and justice are. teach them it's their responsibility, not only to honor it, but to do it. Well, I love that God treated Abraham as a friend. I'm going to share this with you, Abraham. I'm going to tell you what I'm about to do. He had chosen him. He had made him his friend. He had known him. And now in verses 20 through 23, he shares his plan with him. And the plan is basically this, picking up the pace a little bit. I'm going to Sodom and Gomorrah, and I'm going to take an eye look at it. I'm going to put my eyes on that scene. And if it is as bad as I've heard it is, I'm going to destroy those two cities. I'm going to wipe them out, wipe them clean. I'm going to take everybody in those cities. I'm going to kill them. And Abraham speaks. Because now we've looked at this God of love, this God of attention, this God of care and sharing with Abraham. And now we move over to this other side and we see this God of justice, of judgment. Same God. Same God. Now my guess is, until I spoke those words about what God's plan was, you had really warm feelings about that God. Oh, I like this. I like the way Ralph's talking about him. I never thought about God being so warm and so not condescending, but accepting of what Abraham's trying to do and blessing them with the show. Oh, I like that God. I like that God. I like singing about God of love. I like those things. And then I said, and God says, I'm going to wipe them all out. And then we go, I'm not as comfortable with that. I don't know that I like that God as much. Surely there's something can be done about that. Because we love that other God. But many of us are not real happy with this God, the one on this side of the stage. The God who says, I'm killing them all. God has reasons for doing what he's doing. And I like the way Abraham tries to understand this God. This one, he's in awe of. Anybody listening by podcast has no idea what's going on right now because they can't see it. But this God of love, oh, they like him. And Abraham is in awe of that God. He loves that aspect. But now he's seeing the other side of that God. Not another God, the other side of that God. And it's justice and judgment. And so here's what Abraham says. Will you, verse 23, indeed, will you sweep away the righteous with the wicked? What if there are 50 people within that city? Righteous people within that city. Would you sweep the whole city away and not spare the place for the sake of the 50 righteous who are in it? I want you to notice something. I want you to notice what Abraham's doing. He's not just arguing for the salvation and sparing of the righteous. He's asking for the sparing of the wicked because there are righteous there. Did you catch that? He's saying, surely you're not going to wipe them out. Now, what's his point? Well, I want to suggest to you, Abraham cares about the Sodomites. He cares about the people of Gomorrah. He knew their king. He had rescued their citizens on one occasion when they had been beset. He has relatives there, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of at least 7 or 8 relatives there in that city. He loves, respects, and wants to see the preservation of the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. So he's asking the question, how can you destroy them all, God? How can you do that? And so he begins probing God with a series of questions about what he might see as injustice there. But there's always this caveat that he speaks in verse 25. He thinks it's in his favor. Abraham thinks this is the trump card. This one will win. It's the wild card. When I play this, the game is over. It is the words, "Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth deal justly?" Did you hear that? Justly. To Abraham's mind, this isn't justice. This doesn't feel like justice. He knows those people. Despite the fact that they're engaged in some things that are pretty horrendous, as we'll see in the next chapter, his thinking is, but they're good people. I know them. My family lives among them. They ought to be spared. Will not the judge of all the earth deal justly? And you know what the answer to that is? Yes. Yes, he will. But it didn't end up the way you think it would. I think we need to be so careful about playing the justice, judgment, right call and card with God. It may not end up the way we want it to. God, do the right thing. Have we not all been there? Boy, I have. I'm driving down the road and all of a sudden a guy goes past me on the interstate. And I'm saying, where are the cops? Well, they're at the same place they were last week when I went down the interstate. And sometimes they get those other guys. I go down the interstate and I see there is a cop and there is that guy and justice has been done. And sometimes it's me on the side of the road and the cop's writing me the ticket and justice has been done. This God of judgment, this God of justice that Abraham is dealing with, Abraham feels will spare Sodom because God is going to do the right thing. And in fact, God is going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah because he is going to do the right thing. Oh, trysting place where heaven's love and heaven's judgment meet. It's right here. This same God of love who's been so kind to Abraham, who's been so relationally oriented toward him, is the same God who is going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. But in doing that, he will spare the only righteous people left in that city. Two sides of the same God meeting in this story, But you know where else is a trysting place and so aptly named? The supper you and I are about to partake of. The supper where heaven's love and heaven's judgment and justice meet. They are about to meet at the cross. The God of justice condemns all humanity. Romans chapter 3, verse 23, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. All have sinned. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And the wages of sin is what? Death. And God says you deserve to die. I'm sorry, that's justice. You chose your path. You weren't born with it. You chose the path of sin you engaged in. You deserve to die. And love says to justice, can we meet? And God says, I love this world. I so love this world that I will give my only begotten Son in its place. We celebrate this morning the trysting place of love and justice. And I have 2 points, and we'll take the supper. If you ever wonder how God feels about sin, you go to the cross. You watch what payment God exacted for sin. Look what he allowed to happen to his Son. Acts chapter 2, verse 23. Peter says on the day of Pentecost, this man, delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you nailed to a cross by the hands of godless men and put him to death. Want to know how God feels about sin? Look at the cross. The God of justice demands the penalty be paid. You want to know how God feels about you? Go to the cross. Look what he paid for you and for me, for all of us. What we're celebrating today is not some act in isolation. It is a revelation of the very heart of God who loves us so much that he didn't exact the punishment for sin from us, but instead allowed his Son to stand between us and take it for us. Oh, trysting place where heaven's love and heaven's justice, judgment meet. That's what we're celebrating today. Let's do that now.